for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. President Obama called a tentative compromise reached by Senate Democrats on a government-sponsored health insurance option, quote, a creative new framework. The administration is working on a plan to use leftover TARP funds for small businesses to boost employment. And a House vote is expected on the most sweeping legislation for governing Wall Street since the New Deal. Joining me in the studio for this week's domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup, Jerry Seib of the Wall Street Journal, Gene Cummings of Politico, and David Wellner of National Public Radio, NPR. We are taking your calls, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us through Facebook and Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good to see you. David Wellner, how much do we know about the compromise that's been announced by Senator Reid, and is it hoped for or is it reached?
The compromise is reached in the sense that what they worked out, this group of five liberal Democratic senators and five centrist Democratic senators, the agreement they worked out was sent to the Congressional Budget Office to be scored for its cost. So that is sent off. The details of it are very sketchy still. What we know broadly is that it really has two components. One is to set up a kind of national insurance program that would be run by private insurance companies, but would be administered by the Office of Personnel Management. The OPM currently administers the program for federal employees that's very similar to this, and it would be built on that model, and it would be something that would be for small businesses or for people who are uninsured. That would be an alternative, really, to a public option, and it gives those who've said that they won't vote for a bill with a public option the possibility of voting for this, although it has a backstop that if this doesn't work, that there would be a public option that would go into effect. That's the one side of it. The other part of it, which, and of course that pleased centrists, and it annoyed a lot of liberals. Liberals, though, did get something that they wanted, which was an expansion of eligibility for Medicare from right now it starts at 65, age 65. It would come down to age 55. Those ages 55 to 64 who are uninsured right now, and only those who are uninsured, would be eligible to buy into Medicare. What's not at all clear, though, is how much they would have to pay each month to do so.
David Wellner, he's congressional correspondent for National Public Radio. Gene Cummings, what about the Republican reaction on this?
Well, the Republicans are maintaining the same position broadly, most of them, and that is that they're opposed to anything. They're opposed to this one in particular because they believe an expansion of the enrollment in Medicare is a mistake. Medicare is already in a lot of financial distress, as we all know, and they argue that putting more people into that system would only increase cost and possibly jeopardize its financial stability.
So what's the rationale for expanding the program?
As David said, we don't know all of the details, but one thing that we have been told is that the people in this decade bracket, 55 to 65, who chose to buy into Medicaid would not be subsidized. Would not be subsidized in the same manner that those who are 65 and older. This could, some estimates say, cost someone who buys into it a pretty good amount of money. Could be as high as like $600 a month to buy in. Which may be a bargain if you have health problems and you know health costs can run a heck of a lot higher than $600 a month, but it's not cheap either. So what critics argue is even given that, though, let's say they aren't subsidized and they're going in on their own dime pretty much, that what you've done is you've created this new constituency of people who will then appeal to future Congresses to get the same kind of subsidies that the 65 and older crowd get.
Jean Cummings, she's Politico's assistant managing editor in charge of enterprise. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Jerry Seib at the Wall Street Journal. What is it going to take to get a health care bill to the president's desk by the end of the year?
Well, first it'll take one of two senators, I think, Ben Nelson of Nebraska or Olympia Snowe, a Republican from Maine, to sign up to the compromise that David and Jean have been discussing, because that probably gets the Senate to 60, and assuming that independent senator, sort of Democrat, independent senator Joe Lieberman buys into this plan too, that's probably going to happen, because what the clever part of what Senator Reid has come up with here is he is come up with a solution that allows people who want a public option, a government-run health care program, to say, well, we saved the idea, and allows those people who are opposed to that, like Senator Lieberman, to say, well, we killed the idea. Nobody's quite sure whether this is a public option or not. So it is an artful compromise, and that probably clears the way for the 60 votes that are needed in the Senate to get this through past a filibuster. Then the question becomes, can the House buy into this? And there's going to be a problem there among liberal Democrats who are not going to like the death of a real public option. And there's going to be a problem with conservative Democrats who are not going to like the fact that this bill that's coming out of the Senate will not have, most likely, the language that they inserted that restricts funding of abortion in any way, in any insurance plan that gets public subsidies. So there's still some big question marks, but, you know, I think what Democrats are displaying here is a real eagerness to get something done and to make the compromises necessary to do that and not to let this collapse into failure.
David.
Well, I think that there's a potential problem with Lieberman in that if they keep the backstop of a public option in there, he says he won't vote for the bill. That still is a deal breaker for him. Olympia Snowe has problems with expansion of Medicare. Yeah. So in one way or another, they're going to have to address those problems. They'll satisfy one, they get 60. They satisfy the other, they may get 60.
So is your prediction that they will get a bill to the president by the end of the year?
There is tremendous confidence among Democrats that they are on the way to getting a bill by the end of the year. And they may be in session the week between Christmas and New Year's to make that happen. And Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, has said that she'd be willing to have the House in session to conference a bill. The feeling is that if they get this done by the end of the year, then they can move on to the next big issue, which is jobs.
Jean.
I think it might take a Christmas miracle to have them complete this by the end of the year. I know there are a lot of people banking on just before State of the Union as a more realistic date. The problems that Jerry mentioned are real, and because of the structure of the Senate, one person can hold this whole thing up for, you know, 48 hours, and that could be enough to push us over into the next year. I think that this morning we're reporting that Lieberman, Nelson, and Snowe are all raising a lot of concerns about this agreement given the buy-in provision. I think that's not really steady yet. I think there's a chance that in the end they're going to have to tinker with this thing one more time before they finally get there. So I really think we can identify the hurdles ahead of us, but getting over them is going to take a mighty bit of effort.
Well, and that's why I assume Senator Reid has been so careful not to let the details of this compromise come out, because as soon as they come out, they look like they're set in concrete. People have something to object to. Right now, the three key senators that Jean mentioned can all lay down their markers, and the language can be played around with before it becomes really official or public to try to take those objections into account. So you're almost seeing a public and a private negotiation being conducted simultaneously.
What about the general public and its feelings about a health care bill, David Wilna?
I think there is disappointment on the part of President Obama's liberal base that there isn't a stronger public option, at least coming out of the Senate. The House does have a more robust public option. And I think there's also a sense that this thing is not going to necessarily solve the problem of rising health care costs. And I think that the polls are reflecting that support for this health care overhaul has been dropping precipitously. And it's,
why do you think that is?
Well, for one thing, Republicans have been very effective, I think, in arguing that this is going to be, in effect, a tax hike on people.
More effective than Democrats.
Democrats have not been able to make enough of a case. And I think one problem they point to is that President Obama is not out there making enough of a case.
Well, and one reason they haven't been making a strong case is because they don't have a bill. They don't have anything to sell yet. And so I think that does affect the polls. I think people are confused. They don't understand what's going to pass, and rightly so. The three of us sitting right here, the four of us, we don't know what's going to pass. We don't know what's in the bill. The public is even more befuddled by the process and has nothing to either wrap their arms around and support or to outright reject. I think another problem that is reflected in the polls is that I think that the public's concern about jobs and economy remains their primary concern, and there is some frustration. I went to a focus group a couple weeks ago, and there is frustration among the voters that isn't the top priority. And so by default, if healthcare is what's in the way of making the economy the top priority, well, then they don't like it. They want to move on. They want to put this aside. They want to focus on jobs.
So interesting, because right from the start of his administration, President Barack Obama said that you've got to solve health care first before you can deal with the other programs in the economy. When we come back, we're going to talk about the TARP, the Treasury extension of that TARP, in order to help create jobs and help out small business. Welcome back to the domestic hour of our Friday News Roundup. Here in the studio, Gene Cummings of Politico, David Weln of NPR, and Jerry Seib. He's executive Washington editor for The Wall Street Journal. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Jerry Seib, we heard a lot this week from Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner on extending the TARP. Explain what that means and what it will do.
TARP was the $700 billion slush fund, essentially, that Congress and originally the Bush administration set up a year ago to help bail out the financial industry. And the use of that money was supposed to expire. The ability of the White House to use that money was supposed to expire at the end of the year. The administration has said, let's extend it through October because we may need some of that money. We don't right now, But as a cushion, as a safety net, we think we should have the ability to use unspent money in the TARP just in case. Now, the reality is that about $500 billion of that money was spent. About $200 billion was either not spent or has been returned to the Treasury. So there's about $200 billion
returned
left.
Returned how?
By banks that got a bailout saying, we're in good shape now, we're going to pay the Treasury back.
Now, Bank on of the America other hand, Republicans don't want to use this right. money. They want to pay down the deficit.
Well, and they have a point because the original legislation said unspent money should be returned to the Treasury and should be used to pay down the debt. That was the idea all along. So the administration is walking a tightrope here. What it's saying is we would like to take a chunk of the $200 billion that has not been spent, maybe $50 billion or so, and use that essentially to make loans to small businesses, because that's the big problem in finishing up the economic recovery. Small businesses still can't get credit from banks in many cases. That stops them from expanding. It stops them from creating jobs. In some cases, it's shutting them down. So the administration is going to make the argument, let's use some of that money for that purpose, and yes, we'll be true to the original idea and use the rest to pay down the deficit.
And what are economists saying about whether use this money to help small business could truly create jobs, Gene?
Well, they're mixed on it. I mean, there are some who think that getting some really targeted help out there to small businesses will be helpful. But, you know, we have a huge economy, and this $50 billion is sort of like dropping a pebble in, you know, a giant body of water. It's, so there are others who say it's too small and that it's not going to have any kind of dramatic or major impact, and that it's really just a way for the White House and the Democrats to send a political message that they are trying to do something to help the economy and help the jobs market in particular.
David Wellner.
I think that you're going to see initiatives coming from Congress to have kind of a jobs bill. In the House, they're talking about something that would range in size from $75 to $150 billion. And the debate is about whether this should be centered almost exclusively on small business.
Right.
It does generate maybe 70% of the jobs. At the same time, those jobs don't seem to be materializing at the rate that the government at least had promised. And there's a lot of pressure now to have government-led job creation, mainly through infrastructure projects, and have a kind of a New Deal approach to restoring jobs to the economy.
Remember all that talk about shovel-ready projects? What happened, David?
Well, there were a number of shovel-ready projects. A lot of them had to do with road building. And I've looked at how the stimulus money is being spent, and indeed a lot of it is going to road building. They're going to probably have another big infusion for the highway fund before the end of the year, and that would help as well.
It's timing. I mean, the way they structured the stimulus is that it was going to hit the economy in like three waves, and we're coming up on what essentially is the last of those waves, and that is the infrastructure projects. And if you go and you look on recovery.gov, you'll see that the contracts now are being signed. And so what the White House expects is that in the coming, the beginning of 2010, that's when those projects will really start to become much more robust.
Kicking in.
That's right.
Providing jobs.
Yes, okay. Exactly. And you also, in part of his little stimulite that he's working with here, part of that is going to be a couple more pieces of chunks of cash to go to infrastructure type jobs.
All right. And the House is trying to decide to do something about expiring tax breaks.
Right. And that's a subject that has probably got some bipartisan support. You know, there were a series of tax breaks in the stimulus bill designed to make it easier for businesses to expense equipment, which helps them get into the marketplace and buy equipment, which keeps some people in the high-tech industry in particular working. Those were all things that were seen as basically smart, successful ideas in the stimulus package. Not big, but by both parties. And so I think that one of the things that would be in a jobs bill that David referred to would be an extension of those kind of tax credits, which had the advantage of being appealing to Democrats because they look stimulative, and appealing to Republicans because they're tax breaks, which Republicans can always get together behind.
Dave.
But the Senate could be a problem with that, because in the Senate there's not much enthusiasm for the way that the House wants to pay for those tax extenders, which is by adding new taxes to brokerage firms and others who are perceived, at least, to be making out very well with this resurgence of the economy. And so while it is likely to go through the House, its future's uncertainty in the Senate, just as the estate tax that the change of the rules of the estate tax that the House approved last week has a very uncertain future in the Senate. In the Senate, they'd like to have more generous terms for the estate tax. And there's a question of whether that would be done before the end of this year, because the estate tax goes away entirely next year, but just for the
year. For 1 year.
Yes.
For 1 year.
Right.
And then
comes back to life in 2011 at a higher rate. So.
There's also continuing debate in the House on financial reform. What's that all about, Jerry, and how much reform can we truly expect?
Well, this is the effort that the administration launched with a lot of fanfare earlier in the year that was essentially supposed to rewrite the rules of financial regulation in the wake of the economic crisis, saying the argument from the administration was, there are some reasons that the meltdown happened. It's because the regulatory system wasn't designed to find the kinds of problems, particularly in the mortgage industry, that developed because of new financial tools that are out there in the marketplace. We need a better regulatory system. So that's been working its way slowly through Congress. The House is right on the verge of passing a financial regulation.
And this would be huge.
It would be the biggest rewrite of the financial regulatory system since the Great Depression. So it's very big and very meaningful. The House is close to passing it, but it still has to clear two big hurdles first. One is to decide whether to resurrect an idea that Democrats like, which is to allow bankruptcy judges to essentially rewrite mortgage terms when a family goes into bankruptcy. The bigger problem is that some people in both parties want to kill off a big element of this reform, which is the creation of a consumer protection agency to look out specifically for consumer interests in the financial marketplace. Banks hate it. The financial industry hates it. Republicans hate it. And some Democrats are lobbying against it. That's the big test vote yet to happen. Now, when all this is done in the House, it comes to a dead stop anyway, because the Senate is much further behind. And this isn't going to happen as a final product until next year.
Jerry Seib of the Wall Street Journal, Gene Cummings of Politico, and David Wilna of NPR. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Gene, in the meantime, with all of this going on, we see that polls are showing that President Obama's approval rates are going down.
Yes, he's spending quite a bit of political capital in his first year in office. Part of that is independents who have become either he's lost his luster with them, or they are full of anxiety and they don't necessarily see that he's focused on their top priority, which is the economy. And they don't understand the healthcare debate, and they're afraid of it. I think what you saw is the Republicans have all gone home, and the independents now are starting to slip. And, you know, it is not good for the Democrats to have him fall, because it cuts at his ability to sell various programs. But, you know, we've seen a steady decline, but you know, we're really early here, and we just got to see that if they do finally get over this giant hump of health care and get on to the topic that the voters do really care about, at this focus group, it was palpable.
Really?
That they
can
only
you tell
care
us
about.
Where this
it, sure,
was.
It was in Philadelphia with people who came from the suburbs. A variety of suburbs. There was a mix, of course, of Republicans and Democrats there. But the partisan lines didn't really matter. When the economy came up, all other conversations stopped. And they went around the room, and all but perhaps two had really specific negative things happen in their lives because of what's going on with the economy. There was one woman there who is out of a job. Her brother is out of a job. Her father is out of a job. And her other brother, it took him 9 months to find a new job. She's a Democrat. She still supports Obama, but she really would prefer they not be talking about health care right now and that they be talking about the economy. Now, you put that template on an independent, and the independent is probably going to give Obama some bad marks because they don't have any sense of party loyalty necessarily. So, I mean, that we, you know, there he's going to go up and down. He's trying to do big things, but it's you know, they really have to kind of move on to the next topic.
And the next topic could well be the 2010 elections, which the administration has got to be very concerned about.
They are. Democrats know they're going to take losses. They only hope the losses in the House are, you know, in the historic range, which would be 25 to 30 seats and not more than that, and that they can maintain control of the Senate, which they should do. One of the interesting things about the political environment right now, which people need to bear in mind, is that, you know, we tend to think of politics as a zero-sum game, which is to say that if Democrats are down, Republicans are up. Well, that's really not happening right now. Democrats are down and Republicans are down. And that's a very volatile environment. And it's very hard to predict what that implications of that are in the ballot box or how it's going to develop over the next year.
When you say Democrats are down, Republicans are down, what are the polls showing there? Why are you saying that?
Well, because I think people are really unhappy with Washington in general. I mean, this notion that they're not solving my problems, they're arguing with each other, that's a bipartisan sentiment, and it's directed to some extent at both parties. So it is not obviously clear that unhappiness with either President Obama or with the Congress that's run by the Democrats necessarily translates in a straight line way to an advantage for the Republicans, at least not yet.
Jerry Seib of the Wall Street Journal. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I want to ask you about some recent security lapses that we've seen around Washington. There certainly was one huge one at the White House state dinner for the Prime Minister of India, but there have been several. What's going on here? Is it that the Secret Service has somehow become so large and become so responsible for too many activities? Is it that Janet Napolitano, who has initiated some unspecified actions against TSA personnel because they bungled stuff? I mean, what's going on here, David Wellner?
Well, actually, there have been many incidents with the Secret Service over the years. This was one that the Salahi couple who sneaked into the state dinner was the most visible event. But there have been other slip-ups in the past. And I think part of this also had to do with the fact that you had new people at the White House. This was their first state dinner. They hadn't been through this drill before. And there probably were slip-ups there. The White House is not going to make available the director of social affairs there.
Social secretary. Right.
For Congress to quiz the Salahi couple has been subpoenaed now to appear, even though they say they're going to take the Fifth. But I think that this is a problem where the Secret Service really can't be that forthcoming about what their methods are, because that's one way that they protect the people they protect is to keep things secret. On the other hand, with the TSA, you don't even have a director of the TSA. The nomination has been bottled up in the Senate for months now, and there's a sense that there's not much direction from the top there.
What about this publication of materials that indicated exactly how airport security is operated, Jerry?
Well, I mean, that looks to be essentially a computer error. I mean, the idea was to post on a public site for government contractors to look at the procedures for airport screening, so that people who want to bid on contracts for equipment and services in that area know what they're bidding on. The there was supposed to be a redaction, which means the removal of that document from some of the sensitive stuff. It was blacked out, but wasn't really removed from the computer from the background of the computer, so people found it. It probably raises a question about the procedure for getting such documents in circulation at all. I think the unfortunate thing from the TSA's point of view and from the Department of Homeland Security's point of view, it just happened to coincide with the Secret Service mess up on the state dinner, and so it looks like a trend. You know, two makes a trend,
yeah.
and it's an uncomfortable juxtaposition of two embarrassing episodes.
Well, both of them, they're human errors in both cases. I mean, a contract employee screwed up in putting that up on the web. My guess is what Napolitano was not talking about is that contract employee isn't employed by our government anymore. And if you look at the breaches that the Secret Service had to talk about, the number is startling, 90 or 91. But that's over the course of a pretty good period of time. I think it was two decades. And most of them, or a big chunk of them, were people who, like, leap over the fence of the White House.
Somebody drove a minivan in.
Yeah, they get tackled, like, right away. And so, now, there's no question that the Virginia couple got way too close to the president. And they, the Secret Service talk about layers of security. And so getting past the guy with the list of guests is one thing, but walking through this, the metal detectors is another one, and then there are the other men and officers who are around the president. So, there are layers to them, but basically people are going to make mistakes.
Jean Cummings of Politico. When we come back, it's time to open the phones, take your calls, your email on this week's domestic news on our Friday News Roundup. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at MacFound. By REI, providing outdoor adventure gear and apparel for camping, hiking, and cycling, in stores and at REI.com. And by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. This is NPR.
The Friday News Roundup. President Obama accepts the Nobel Peace Prize. General Petraeus tells Congress things in Afghanistan will get worse before they improve. And the UK government proposes a one-time 50% tax on bankers' bonuses. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. We'll go right to the phones, 800-433-8850, to Jay in Columbus, Ohio. Good morning. Go right ahead.
Good morning. I would like to ask a question. It's come to my attention these past couple of days that the government is not going to pay any interest on United States savings bonds or the interest-bearing savings bonds, and that those monies were going to be used to support the TARP program and other miscellaneous programs. I feel that this is wrong, insensitive, cold-blooded, and stupid policy.
Let's see if we have information on that, Jerry Tsai.
I don't believe that's correct. I mean, I think there may be some confusion here with Social Security benefit increases, which are tied to the rate of inflation, which is essentially zero right now. On that front, Congress is stepping in or will step in and provide a cost of living increase anyway. It has nothing to do with savings bonds, so I think that's incorrect information.
Hey, Jay, where'd you get that information?
I heard it first on the radio, and then I called
the Treasury. Yeah, but where? I'm asking you where you heard
The Treasury Department. I called and confirmed it. I called the savings bonds division of the Treasury Department.
Okay, Jay, we're going to check that out for you while we're on the air and find out whether your information is correct or not. Let's go to Claudio. He's in St. James, New York. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Can you hear me?
Sure can. Go right ahead, sir.
Okay, I'm just calling regarding Obama's approval ratings. And amongst my friends, neighbors, and so on, we're basically concerned that he doesn't call out the special interests by name, politicians, and so on, and, you know, put everybody in check. As I had to write it down because I get a little nervous on my
That's okay, Claudio. What you're saying is you don't feel the president is fighting back hard enough.
He is definitely not fighting back hard enough. I thought, and, you know, it was the first time I ever voted in my life because I didn't see him as a regular politician. I really thought that he had the I was asked not to say this on the air. I don't think it's such a, you know, big problem, but he needs some cojones, as we say here.
All right, let's see what our panelists have to say. David Wilner.
Well, Claudio, one thing that I think sort of illustrates what you're talking about the president not calling out special interests, is a situation in the Senate right now where an amendment was offered to the health care bill that's moving through there right now that would allow the reimportation of drugs from abroad that are cheaper. And this is something that President Obama supported when he was in the Senate. It's also something that Rahm Emanuel, his chief of staff, backed when he was in the House. And now the White House has said that they like the idea of reimporting drugs, but Pharma, which is the big pharmaceutical lobby, has made this informal agreement that they would back the bill in exchange for a certain shielding from further cuts in their revenues. And to allow these drugs to be reimported would cut into their revenues. And so you're getting pushback from the FDA saying we don't think that this is safe enough, and it seems that now that the tables have turned. This is one of the problems, I think, of being in power, that some of these interests you have to have as allies, and at the same time it comes at a certain price of credibility.
Jean?
Oh, I think that it is a matter of expectations. I mean, Washington, he promised he was going to change Washington, and Washington doesn't change very easily.
That's the problem.
Yes, it
you
is the problem.
You run into entrenched bureaucracies. You run into entrenched individuals within their political positions.
You do. But these deals that have been cut on health care reform, they do involve, to some degree, real financial concessions by some of these stakeholders. Certainly the insurance companies don't feel like they've gotten a free ride. They were beat up on pretty badly, and they didn't come to the table, and they didn't make an offer, and so they've taken the heat for it.
All right. Here is an email from Ben, who's in Baltimore, Maryland. He says, one huge problem with jobs is the crushing cost of health care. So, by necessity, health care reform will benefit many levels of the economy. Why isn't there more discussion about this on the media? Well, we're here talking about it, Jerry.
Well, two reasons, really. The first is that it is uncertain to a lot of people who know a lot more about health care than I do that the bill as constructed has enough in it to actually hold down the cost of health care for the country, the overall health care system. Does it have the right kinds of things to inject market forces and to stop unnecessary medical procedures and that sort of thing, which would have the effect of lowering the bill? So, the emailer is right. That's the goal. The question is, does this get us there? That's the first thing. The second thing is that you have businesses saying, and this is true of small businesses and large businesses, that the legislation is creating a climate of uncertainty about what my health costs are going to be for my business. And if I'm in an uncertain environment, I'm not going to take the chance of adding employees. So I'm frozen in place by the healthcare uncertainty. Now, when there's a bill in place and people start to know the answers to those questions, maybe that goes away. But right now, that is one of the real-world effects.
All right, to Mina in St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I live for Friday Political Roundtable, so thank you for taking my call. My husband and I own a small construction business, and my question is about this TARP money, leftover money, whatever they're wanting to call it. You know, there seems to be this huge gap. The money's over here, and there's this huge space, and we're way down here. And how does that money help us? You know, we want to purchase land for new construction, and we have good credit, but right now banks would lock their doors if they saw us coming. You know, and so I guess I'm not clear on exactly how and how long it's going to take for this money to get to people like my husband and I.
It's a little unclear how the proposal would be structured because they've just now begun talking about it. But the Treasury Secretary is talking about trying to create a separate pool that would hold the money that's for small business loans only. And a way to get the banks then to be enthusiastic about managing that pool of money and those loans would be to separate it from the TARP program itself so that the banks that would participate in that particular program would not be subjected to the other strings that are attached to TARP, like compensation issues and that sort of thing, which is what has made banks reluctant to really embrace any new government TARP-like program because they're afraid of more strings. They're trying to get out from those right now. So Geithner has suggested that this be an isolated pool, no strings attached, so that and dedicated solely to small businesses. Now, if that requires legislation and that sort of thing, it's going to take some time. If the Treasury could figure out a way to make it happen without having to go to Congress, it could happen more quickly.
David Wellner.
One of the ironies of those strings being attached is that, especially when it comes to executive compensation, that was a huge stimulus for those that receive bailout money to repay it. And right now, there are very few who left with money to repay. AIG and the auto companies have yet to repay their money. But really, the big banks have essentially repaid this money, and it does give the government less sway over those institutions since they've repaid it.
All right. Jerry Seib, let's go back to the earlier caller's question about interest being paid on savings bonds.
Yeah, there's a confusion here. Savings bonds are a contract by the government. They will pay savings bonds rates. That's not in question. I think there's some confusion about Treasury bonds. The bonds the Treasury Department sells into financial markets essentially to borrow money for the U.S. government to pay its debts and to pay its deficit. There is a question on those of whether in the long run people want to hold those Treasury bonds if they think the U.S. government does not have the solvency to continue to pay them off. First of all, the rates are very low right now, and that may not be a good investment for 10 years. It doesn't mean the government won't pay the 3% interest that they're promising. It just means that if inflation is at 10%, you're going to not have a very good investment. That's item A. Item B, a lot of the value of Treasury bonds, not savings bonds, but Treasury bonds, lies in your ability to sell them to somebody else when you want your money back and that there will be a market for them. If Treasury bonds are not seen as a good investment, either because the government is not in great shape or because the interest rate is so low as inflation increases in the coming years, you're not going to find anybody to buy your Treasury bond. It's not worth as much as you thought it was going to be because you can't resell it. Those are both real dangers, but they don't have anything to do with the caller's impression that savings bonds would not be paid off. That's a different issue entirely.
Do we have a savings bond interest rate that's going right now.
That varies, and I don't know what it is now. But what that is essentially a government guarantee that if you buy a $50 savings bond for $40, that in when the bond matures, you can go to the bank, and the government, through the bank, will give you your $50 for the $40 investment.
There's no risk
in that at all, but that's entirely different from buying bonds from the Treasury Department, which many people buy on the assumption that they'll be able to resell it to somebody else down the road when they want all their money.
I hope that is a very clear explanation and clears up the confusion. Let's go to Novi, Michigan. Good morning, Juanita. You're on the air.
Thank you. Thank you. I had two questions for your panel. I'm really concerned about being distracted by these two major issues, the public option and the abortion, which are, you know, important, but there are thousands of pages in this bill. And in the Senate bill in particular, there was a section that called for the mandating of the creation of some so-called community-based organizations. It was actually titled Creating Healthier Communities. And it called for the kind of creation of this massive national database that was supposed to, or that is supposed to monitor individual behavior patterns, kind of on the neighborhood level in the schools. And the details were actually spelled out in this article. And I just quickly, it talked about the eligible entity. It didn't, whoever these organizations are, shall, didn't say may, but they shall, with respect to residents in the community, measure 1, decreases in weight. 2, increases in proper nutrition. 3, increases in physical activity. 4, decreases in tobacco use prevalence. 5, other factors using community-specific data from, quote, the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance Survey. Now, what concerns me, my question for the panelists, is that are we just blindly signing up for things? Do we really know? My question is, number one, has any of the panel actually had an opportunity to read the entire bill? And number two, if they have, did they notice any reference to this section referring to data from this behavior?
All right. Jean?
Well, we don't have a bill yet, so we don't know exactly what will be in the bill. I presume that's based on
thousands of pages out there.
And that's the section that she is speaking about. Which I suppose whoever wrote the article might have been dealing with the House bill, because they have passed one. That is an area where the government is trying to monitor, to measure what works and what doesn't work. And there is a big brother nature to health care reform. And if we are going to be a healthier society, then we have to curb our own behavior. I mean, the best way to reduce costs in the healthcare system is if everybody starts living in a healthier way. And so there are many experimental programs inside of healthcare reform that are designed to study different programs to see if they help people live better and to find ways to monitor patient behavior to make sure people are taking their drugs if they have chronic illness.
Jean Cummings of Politico, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. David Wilna.
Well, I think there is a lot of suspicion about the reach of government with this bill. You see the gun lobby right now warning its members that they may end up having to pay higher insurance rates because they own guns, or people who have a history of mental illness being unable to buy guns because these records will be more available. And I think Jean's right that there is a sense of Big Brother. At the same time, I guess if you want to keep track of public health and the Centers for Disease Control wants to do that very much, you have to have that kind of granular data coming from communities. And in some ways, I suppose you could argue that this would also be reason for some communities to get extra assistance if they have particular problems, especially if they're problems that come from public health menaces such as pollution. It's hard to see how it would play out.
All right. One last call from Stephen, who's in Baltimore, Maryland. You're on the air. Please go quickly.
Hi. I'm an independent voter, and I have to say over the last 9 months, I've been actually impressed with the way the three branches of government are actually functioning. I see spirited debate, I see negotiation, and I see alternatives. And my biggest concern is that the Republican Party seems to be almost being lockstep as the party of no. I would like to see them come up with some more options. I know they're not in power, but at least just don't say no to everything.
Jerry.
Well, I think that, first of all, puts Stephen in a minority of people who are happy with the way the government is running. But secondly, he points to the problem Republicans have, in which they now, I think, increasingly recognize, which is that by simply opposing Obama administration initiatives, they fall into the trap of being portrayed as the party of no, and they're very conscious of that. It's why you've seen a lot more effort by Republicans just in the last couple of weeks to offer jobs programs of their own, not to simply say, no, we don't want another stimulus package, but to say, let's instead do this. Now, whether they'll get any resonance and traction with the public is an open question.
I think we also see that with the health care bill in the Senate, that rather than simply blocking the bill's passage or its movement forward, Republicans are actually offering amendments and, in a sense, trying to improve the bill. And they're taking quite a lot of heat from their far right, from people like Rush Limbaugh, who says, you should just block this bill. You should not be trying to improve it. I think that these Senate Republicans just figured that they do not want to be seen as pure obstructionists.
Well, and I think in the end, it could have been a very different bill. If you look at how much Snow and Collins, two Republican senators, can influence a final outcome, if there had been 10 of them, we would have been looking at an entirely different bill.
Jean Cummings, she's with Politico. David Wellner, congressional correspondent for NPR, and Jerry Seib, he's executive Washington editor of The Wall Street Journal. Thank you all so much. The discussion goes on. Have a great weekend, everybody. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.